Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Mikhail Carter. Today, I'm joined with Drs. Francois Hamlin and Dr. Charles McKinney to discuss their latest book, From Rights to Lives, The Evolution of the Black Freedom Struggle, published with Vanderbilt University Press. Dr. Hamlin is the Royce Family Associate Professor of Teaching Excellence in Africana Studies and History at Brown University, and Dr. McKinney is Chair of Africana Studies and an Associate Professor of History at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. In their edited book, From Rights to Lives, the authors dwell into the dynamic relationship between the civil rights movement and Black Lives Matter movement within the Black freedom struggle timeline. They grapple with how our understanding of the post-war moment shapes our analysis of Black Lives Matter, shedding light on the discontinuities that exist. Thank you both for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Of course. So let's start off by what motivated you both to write this book? What's the backstory behind it?
Well, the backstory behind it. Again, I just want to say I'm just really happy to be here. So the backstory behind it was a number of years ago, right? I mean, before COVID, right? And time is a flat circle with COVID, right? You know, so 2017, 2018, there was an uptick of work coming out on Black Lives Matter. And as a historian, I'm always curious about how historians are thinking about, you know, contemporary moments of liberation, particularly as a civil rights historian, right? So this sort of started percolating in my mind, right, in terms of, you know, how are we placing what we started to call these moments, these current moments, contemporary moments of liberatory possibility. How are we placing them in larger, broader historical context? And there had been a few works that had come out, you know, Kianga Yamada Taylor's book was out, Barbara Ransby's book, with, you know, both monumental studies of the contemporary period. But I started to think about what would it look like to place these moments, to place this moment, the contemporary moment, in dialogue, in conversation with the Black freedom struggle of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And so so as the idea sort of grew, the other question for me became, okay, who does it make sense to take this ride with, right? Who wants to join me on this fantastic voyage, right? And so, and I answered my own question by saying, that would be Francois Hamlin, my homie up at Brown. So I reached out to Francois and she was like, oh, this sounds absolutely ridiculous, and I'm in, right? And so that's kind of how we started, right? You know, we got together and then started to flesh out the idea, flesh out the concepts, to think through and think about, you know, what sorts of themes we wanted to explore. And so then from there, you know, grew the call for papers that we eventually set out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, I think what drew us together, why this project meant a lot to us and made sense, is that these were teaching questions that we were already having these discussions separately in our classrooms. And so when we started talking about it, we had the same questions and answers. And I think that we had been wanting to work together on something. So this happened, and it was pretty quick. Once we decided that it was going to happen, we were going to do it, the call for papers came out pretty quickly. And then everything slowed down because of them.
And then
But yeah.
and I also have to give a shout out to Vanderbilt University Press and the Black Lives Matter series, right? My then colleague at the time, Zandria Robinson, was one of the editors of the series. And so when I pitched her the idea, she was like, yes. Yes, you all should definitely do this book, right? And it should be and it should be in this Black Lives Matter series, right? So the more we talked about the idea and presented the idea to Zandria and some other folks at Vandy, they were all in,
Yeah,
right?
it was pretty easy. We didn't have to sell the book. It was we it had a home immediately. Yeah.
No, that's perfect. Thank you for that. And so, I guess to that point, as far as the type of questions that you guys had, could you talk about what were some of the questions that you guys hoped to see that you guys had when in regards to this project, but then also like what questions remain unanswered for you afterwards?
Well, I'm just thinking of I'm thinking about the experience. So I'm going to talk about the experience that we had, and some of the stuff that we encountered in terms of some of the choices we had to make. And I do think we had to think about how, as we are both historians, even though we're trained as interdisciplinary scholars, because we both believe that to be African Americanist or to work on the Black diaspora, you have to be interdisciplinary just because of sources or lack of. That we wanted to figure out how interdisciplinary did we want the book to be, like, and we didn't want to go too far out of our own comfort zone as editors, but we also wanted to speak to more than historians. And then, of course, the other question was how international were we going to just stick to the US? And then, the thing that happens with calls for paper, it dictates basically what gets included because it's whoever responds, and then the quality of those papers and those applications really did dictate what we included, and we made it work. So that's how I was reading that question, sort of thinking about those ex the sort of those experiences. In hindsight, it would have been nice maybe to have an extra a couple more extra international stories, but I do think the one we included is a really good model to think about the connections, and also just sort of thinking about Black France is not usually done. So having an expert in that was we le definitely learned something from that.
And I think we also, I think one of the things that we were pretty intentional about on the front end too was casting a fairly wide net, right? We came at this as historians, but as Francoise was saying, we really thought we tried to be thoughtful about, about crafting a call that was capacious, right? That did allow a bunch of folks to come in and say, oh, well, yeah, I do that. Right, which is why we can have, right, we've got somebody talking about, we've got Scott Brooks and Aram Gutsuzian talking about Black athletes. We've got Dave Mason, my colleague here at Rhodes, talking about the impact of photography and the nexus of race and photography, right? So he's a visual artist and a photographer thinking about these issues, right? Kashana's piece on Black France. So the book did wind up, while it's edited by two historians, right? It does point towards these other disciplines, and it does point towards these other entryways in terms of how we could think about the project.
And we also wanted to make sure we were, and I think it was more of a political kind of choice, that we wanted to make sure that we span the scope of the academy. So there were senior scholars, there were junior scholars, there were grad students, that we really wanted to think about what's the new work happening, basically. What's the interesting stuff? What's the new work happening? And then how can we as editors be part of the mentoring process? Which is close to us as well. So it was a pedagogical and methodological sort of endeavor for us, purposefully, intentionally.
Yeah, so I do believe like a strength of the book really is like the diversity in regards to like thematically, but then also the disciplines as well. And so I'm interested in the organization. How did you guys go about organizing the chapters of the book?
I can't exactly remember the moment when we did it. It was about at least a year and a half ago when we kind of really knew what was going to be in the book and knew what the chapters were doing. It was a really sort of naturally what followed the next in terms of theme and topic and content. And so we kind of let it, you know, what would read best? And that kind of created the arc. Yeah, I think that's, and I think once we stuck to, once we met, we got it, we kind of stuck to, I don't think we ever questioned it again. I don't, what do you think?
Yeah, no, it was pretty immutable after we first came up with it, right? And I mean, and some the continuity did once, and I think we didn't change it a lot. We didn't change it at all because it made sense the first time we put it together, right? So for instance, Charity Clay's chapter on the similarities between the Trayvon Martin generation and Black Lives Matter, right? We're like, well, that's got to be chapter one, right? I mean, that's going to anchor the book after. I mean, after the introduction, of course, right? And so from there we start to think about so then Christoph Ringer's chapter on continuity and change, spirituality of liberation in the Black Lives Matter movement, this made sense to us, right? For that to be number two, right? So it was kind of like connecting the Legos, right? Once you put the first two in place, then the other ones sort of make sense, right? In terms of the way in which we construct the chapter. Then on the back end, when the Cultural Revolution comes, should be bracketed with the ambivalence of activist photography, right? Here's some folks thinking broadly and deeply about culture. So, it makes sense for those two chapters, for those two exquisite chapters to be placed together. So yeah, it came together. It came together fairly organically.
Nice. So I'm gonna go a little bit off topic, but not for real. It's gonna tie back in, I promise. All right. So Dr. McKinney, you are always dropping gems on Twitter. And so a while ago, you posted the 1955 mugshot of Annie Patterson, and you wrote in quotation, "This isn't your grandmother's movement," right? And so with this, okay, so this kind of tied into the misconceptions of just the civil rights movement and what we often think, right? And so it made me think of Charity Clay's, Dr. Charity Clay's chapter. And so could you talk a little bit about not only just the bar that you just dropped on Twitter, right? But then also just the misconceptions that the book itself tries to debunk.
So that's a great question. So one of the things that we are constantly sort of facing, right, in as two professors who teach and think and write about the civil rights movement, right, is the idea, right, that the idea that young people have that this movement was sort of this movement that's been sort of trapped in amber, right? This movement is symbolized by prayerful, right, Negro students dressed to the nines, engaged in nonviolent protest, right? So they think of that, they think of Martin King, they think of speeches, they think of mass mobilization. So that thinking, right? And a lot of this contem a lot of this a lot of the contemporary understanding about the movement of the 60s has been flattened, right? It's no longer a three-dimensional, complex, complicated, contentious, right, sort of massive actions and reactions, right? It's this, it's a very two-dimensional sort of process. And so we spend a lot of time sort of debunking that, right? We spend a lot of time saying, hey, let's not overestimate and let's not overdetermine people's politics based on what they're wearing in 1960. Right. Let's not overdetermine those things. So conversely, when we come to the contemporary moment, right, 20-year-olds and 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds, there's a critical mass of folks who are thinking that this is the first time this has happened, right? This is, we've never been here before. And the levels of, the levels of confrontation and the different sort of manifestations of the confronting power in 2023, 2022 look different from that of 1962, 1963, right? And so So one of our tasks, right, was to bring some complexity and nuance to that understanding, right? So if you are under the impression that this isn't your grandmother's movement, right? You know, back to that tweet, I was like, well, that depends on who your grandmother was, right? Here's Annie Patterson, you know, here's a very respectable, you know, African American woman in Montgomery, Alabama. Here's her mugshot. Right, she has a mugshot because she was arrested. She was arrested for conspiracy in Montgomery, in you know, in 1955. So, you know, hey, do you have a mugshot? Right, you know, so on and so forth. Right, so,
And what does it mean to have a mugshot then compared to now? I mean,
right,
you know, what kind of
exactly,
risks did these people take at that
right,
time, given
right.
what? So again, it's about teaching that history. Sorry, I butted in.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I think, so after he tweeted that, I kind of did the plug for the book. I'm like, actually, we have a we can answer that question. So
Nicely done. That was brilliant. Nicely done.
Oh, hey, you gotta do what you gotta do. But I think, you know, the idea again, the idea is that there is no answer, right? That these movements are messy. And I think that's really the crux of the book. They're messy, but they're also organized. They can be both at the same time. And that sort of thinking about this as a mass of movements, but also highlighting how history is not being taught properly, or fully, which allows for these misconceptions. And that, well, Chuck and I think that this is purposefully done, right? To divide and conquer both sides. And so, yeah, I think there are so many ways in which we can tie what's going on now and just say, hey, you need to read this book because this is what we're talking about. This is why you
Right.
need to understand the history.
Right. And this gets back to another really significant misconception, right? Is that, you know, almost any and all of the actions of young people are completely and totally spontaneous, right? You know, are simply and solely reactive, right? So when people take to the streets, there's no method to this madness, right? There's no scaffolding, there's no thought. And then from that moment of, right, so it's just sort of arbitrary assertion, then some sort of shape and form happens or is constructed after that moment, right? You know, and so that's one of the other things that we got to sort of grapple with in the book, right? Is that actually, right, these moments of rage do have a form, they do have a shape, they do have a structure, right? And they are also in many instances facilitated by, right, by associations and institutions and organizations, right, that are giving people the space to say, hey, you know what? Yet another black person has been murdered by the cops. What are we going to do? Today, the answer to that question looks like we're going to go shut down Main Street, right? So, you know, so when you get 500 people out shutting down Main Street, you know, that's not just some sort of random assemblage of people who all arrived at the same idea at the same time, right? So again, there's shape, there's content, there's form, there's structure there. What is the nature of that shape, content, form, and structure? And that's what we're trying to grapple with in the book.
Thank you guys. I think you both really answered a question already that I have for you guys, which was like in the book, you remind us that history matters and so why, but you guys answered that beautifully. And so I kind of want to not really circle back, but let's rewind because one thing I'm very interested in is the cover of the book. It's a beautiful cover. So could you just, you know, talk more about it and the significance and how that even came about, the cover itself?
I think we wanted it to reflect the content, right? That these two we're trying to put these two moments in time, these two movements in juxtaposition, but they needed to have images, and images are the easiest way to do it, and have them similarly styled, right? So that it's they there's an easy there's an easy sort of it tells you immediately what the book's about, right? Without even reading the title. And initially we wanted to include a photograph by David Mason, whose work is in the book, whose essay is in the book, but it didn't match. It wasn't the perfect picture that we needed it because we wanted to, you know. So when you look at it, it looks like these, they're really, it looks staged in some ways, but that's what we really wanted to have this kind of juxtaposition, and have something that was really easily recognized. And then the press itself had its own sort of style that they wanted to keep with for the series. So there were some other things that were out of our control, but we wanted to make sure we had those images.
Beautiful. So absolutely love the cover. Great decisions for sure. And so, could you guys discuss what challenges that you faced while working on this project, especially amid the Black Lives Matter movement and the pandemic?
Well, you've answered the question.
Yep.
Right. I mean, we started this process with 2018, Prince was, is that right?
Something like
2018?
that, 2018, 2019, yeah.
2018, 2019, we sent out the call for papers. We got a bunch of responses. We read through the responses. We worked our way towards a set number of chapters, and then bam, right? And then the world shut down.
We definitely lost a couple of years.
We lost a couple of years easy, right? Almost, I'm pretty sure almost, a critical mass of us in the book project caught COVID, got sick. Critical mass of us are teaching, so we're, moving from, real life to Zoom. And yeah, so and life is intervening in other ways in terms of, just life be lifing, right? So that was just like the major, so we lost 2 years, right? When we initially pr pitched this to the press, we were like, hey, it's 2018, we can get this thing out in 2 years, right? Let's, we'll shoot for 2020, 21, something like that, right? So yeah, so that was the biggest thing. But I will say, right out of that challenge, we found, more specifically, Francoise, right, found an opportunity for us, right, which, as you know, was to come together, at Brown and workshop these chapters, right? So we were able, and that was a beautiful process, right? It was generative. It was the beloved community made real for in an intellectual space, right, where all of us got to read everybody else's chapter. We got to workshop the chapters, and I think that's, in addition to, the editorial work that, Francoise and I were putting into the book, that supercharged the process, right? Where you all could get feedback from fellow authors, right? Where everybody wanted to, and so that was, just a beautiful, that was a beautiful opportunity, right? That
Yeah.
we were able to, that we were able to take advantage of.
I definitely think, yes, we lost a couple of years, but I also think in many ways, given that 2020 did happen, if the book had come out then, it wouldn't have been able to include any of that. So for the material that was able, especially the Memphis chapter, right? I mean, the Memphis part at the end, we wouldn't have been able to do that. It wouldn't have looked the same. It would have been a different book. And another thing that we had to do is constantly ask people to update their essays, right, as information, update the dates that they were having, and sometimes, especially if they are talking about the more present moments, is to kind of really up try and keep it as up to date up to the point of publication, so it doesn't fall out of date immediately, that there are some other things there. But I do think the project was definitely enriched by the workshop. And I think that we've actually come to something in terms of thinking about this book as a certain methodology, right? How do you do this work? How do you create edited volumes that mean something to the people creating the book? And I'd like to think that, given sort of the intentional way in which we chose who is included, that meeting together, it's also the networking that couldn't have happened with the pandemic, that was really helpful. And I think we're all kind of bonded by this experience in really interesting and wonderful ways. We've all made friends in this process.
No, for sure. And I didn't mention, but I just want to thank you guys again for including me in your and actually having being able to have a chapter in this amazing book and this amazing work. And that experience was so powerful, especially as a grad student. So thank you guys.
Our pleasure. It was a good chapter.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. And so, okay, so we're kind of winding down into some of the last questions that we have. But I'm going to go to the postscript. So the postscript chapter titled Miraculous, Magnificent, and Messy. It talks about how in the midst of wrapping up and you guys were finishing up the finishing touches of the book in January of 2023, police officers in Memphis murdered Tyree Nichols. And so reading a part of that chapter you guys wrote, the Black folks who sprung to action in the wake of Nichols' murder represent a powerful corrective to simplistic thinking about the construction of a new world. As such, we felt that the conclusion to this book had to continue, albeit briefly, with the events that were unfolded in Bluff City, end quote. And so you guys include interviews of activists on the ground in Memphis and discuss how movement building happens in real time. So could you guys reflect on those interviews with those four Memphis activists and what insights were gained? And also, I want to pose the same question that you guys posed to them. Where do we go from here?
Right. So, we're finishing up, as we literally say in that first chapter, right? We're finishing up edits of the book, and you know, and the cops murder Tyree Nichols here in my city. And you
say
know,
that we didn't have a postscript. We had the intro and we thought we were done, right?
Right.
And the press
right.
were like, no, you need a conclusion. We're like, oh God. We just said everything we had to
like,
say.
Yeah,
so,
right.
We had
right.
to think about something different. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Right. And so, you know, and so tragically, Memphis gives us the material for the postscript. Right. So, so we also saw this as an opportunity. Oh, well, you know, this book is about Black Lives Matter and change over time. This book is about movement building. This book is about movement building in the midst of chaos and terror and repression. So, you know, we have to go and, you know, we have to find some folks who are on the ground who are doing this work, right? That's just simply what has to happen, right? So, we were able to identify four folks who work on the ground here: Shahida Jones, Reverend Dr. Earl Fisher, Shahida Jones with official Black Lives Matter, Earl Fisher, activist who works, who's pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church, Josh Adams, who organized with Memphis for All and Decarcerate Memphis, another local organizing entity, and Amber Sherman, who was also working with Decarcerate and Black Lives Matter and a host of other organizations. And so one of the things that was immediately that was immediately evident in the chapter, right, was the ways in which the political education being provided by Black Lives Matter was shaping the next generation of activists, right? So this gets back to the myth of spontaneity, right? This gets back to that myth that people just sort of go out on the streets and then go home, right? So, you know, so Josh and Amber are specifically shouting out the political education they received by way of Black Lives Matter, by way of Shay Jones, right? You know, Earl Fisher is shouting out, you know, the process that he is a part of in the wake of another police murder, right? Darius Stewart in 2018, he's shouting out, right, that moment in time where people are trying to come together to build movement infrastructure, right? To build movement machinery. How are we going to respond to this? How do our organizations connect and coordinate? What new things do we need to build, right? You know, and again, this goes back, I mean, this is Montgomery, 1955. The NAACP is not getting us where we need to go, mm-hmm. right? You know, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters is not getting it. What do we need to build in this moment, right? And, you know, what others, what's the new stuff that needs to get constructed, right? So we're seeing that process in real time as well.
Sorry to butt in. I think what's really interesting again is thinking about how this is organized, but how folks don't always agree with each other, right? And there's internal dialogue and debate and sometimes argument, like real arguments about method and about who gets to be leader. What does leadership mean amongst these like huge groups of people or like different groups and organizations, and how that is real, right? So the whole messy and magnificent is actually the Reverend's quote. He said that. So it's in that, you know, so we just pulled that out and used it because it was perfect for what we were thinking. And that's how both Chuck and I teach the civil rights movement, right? It's like these folks were arguing all the time, yet the goals might have been the same, but the methods were different. And so what does that look like, you know, and how is it remembered? And I think what these interviews were able to do was to show that in real, like, the nothing's changed. Like, this is, and so that's not an excuse for not doing anything, right? And I think that's what those activists themselves said. It was
Right.
amazing.
And exactly. And the other thing they get to show us is how they're learning in real time. Right. So like, okay, so the last time this happened, here's what we did. Here's what worked and here's what didn't work. Right. So this time around, tragically, because there's always going to be a next time, right? This time around, we get to do something new. We get to try some new tactics. We get to try some new methods, right? We get to tie, right? We get to tie these moment, these th this moment more explicitly to, right, to policy change, right? Which was a major sort of a major shift. Right. You know, that's not to say we didn't see that in earlier periods, but this time around, right, this is foregrounded, you know, the policy shifts. Hey, City Council, we need you to pass these reforms with regard to policing in Memphis, right? So that work gets foregrounded in some really powerful ways, in ways that had been that were less the case back in 2018 and in previous instances. So again, we get to see what we historians love to call change over time. Right, you know, the reactions and responses that we see in 2023 are not the exact same ones that we saw in 2018, and that's again, that's one of the other really powerful lessons. And so, in the midst of this messiness, in the midst of this chaos, in the midst of people trying to figure out what leadership looks like, and all of this other stuff, people are still learning, right? And people are adapting, and people are growing, and the movement is evolving in some really beautiful and powerful ways. And we nailed all of that down in the postscript.
It took a while because we had way
Yes.
too much. We wanted to include everything these amazing people had,
Right.
and then it was
Right.
like, okay, now
Right.
this chapter is messy, so
Yeah.
we need to redo it. And we didn't want it to be a chapter. It was way too long.
Right.
It was actually,
Right.
it ended up being chapter length, and we're like, yeah, no, this is no.
They're like, this is supposed to be a postscript, a coda, you know, a final thought, but we were like, but another thing and another thing, right? And then, you know, and we can blame the four activists for that. They gave us so much really great content. So yeah, and I mean, that's just back to one of your other earlier questions, right? About one of the challenges is that each one of these chapters is an entryway into another set of conversations, another set of questions, right? You know, each of these chapters could be the foundation of another book, right? Which is sort of the beauty and the agony of an edited volume.
No, for sure. And so, could you guys talk about how do you envision the text being used as a teaching tool, whether it be within academia or outside of academia?
I'll start. Well, I think I like to think about method, and I think to start with, how do you create an edited volume? I think we've really come up with the secret sauce with that. And if we ever do this again, I would totally, or I would always say, try and get the group together if you can. Even if, we have technology now, it doesn't have to be in physically, it could be remotely, but to think of this as a sort of a group project and communal, and get sort of the buy-in from everyone. And so the mentoring aspect of it is real, and it really does make a difference to the product, because we all felt very, very invested. So in terms of how knowledge is produced as a teaching tool, I think this is a really interesting example. But then also thinking about how the Black freedom struggle is capacious, and that these are just two moments on this timeline, and how do we talk about it and think about why history matters? And I think that was really what was important to us, into how do we understand what's going on now? We have to think about what happened before. So that for me is sort of the very simplistic way in which it could be used as a teaching tool. And I think because there are so many different kinds of essays in there, folks can dip in and out, and pick up what, whichever parts of it that interest them. But I think the message is pretty consistent throughout.
And I think we've crafted an edited volume that, and I think this is the upside of edited volumes, right? Is that could be used in a wide area of spaces, right? In a number of places and spaces. You know, I could see undergrads reading this book. I can see graduate students contending with this. It's also where one of the things we really emphasized was accessible language, right? You know, we didn't want a lot of jargon, and we didn't want, you know, we didn't want inaccessible language, right? So, you know, so the general public, who's interested in social change, who's interested in, right, the formulations of Black Lives Matter, how people are thinking about Black Lives Matter and the civil rights movement. We're thinking about American history, right? You know, this we hope would appeal to them as well, right? So history classes, African American studies classes, you know, government civics classes, right? You know, urban studies courses, American studies courses, right? You know, so I think there's a bunch of places where this book could hopefully have an impact.
Thank you both. And so we're down to our last question, and the audience definitely would like to know, what are you guys, what are you currently working on? What's next?
The what's next question. So I've got a couple of things in the hopper. I'm working up a political exploration. I'm not calling it a political biography, but a political exploration of a civil rights operative and political operative here in Memphis by the name of George Washington Lee. And so I'm on the front, on the front edges of doing that, of working on that book.
And I'm continuing to work on the project that has been sort of put aside many times to do all these other little projects that are really important and poignant and, like, you know, time sensitive. Is thinking about the cost of freedom for young people during the mass movement, in the civil rights movement, through the lens of trauma. So that's an ongoing project. That is always informed by all this extra stuff in the teaching that we do. So that's what I'm working on next. I'm currently just finishing an essay on Bob Moses for another project, because distractions are sort of my middle name, really. And so I need to get back to the main project, but that's an essay I'm finishing up.
Well, I'm looking forward to both of you guys' work. Both sounds super interesting, and we can't wait to have you guys back on the New Books Network. And yeah, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with the audience about your latest book.
Thank
Thank
you
you
so
so much
much.
for having us. Really appreciate it.